Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome along. It's Unbelievable. And I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the program that brings Christians and non-Christians together every Saturday afternoon as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio. Many thousands of people listen, though, across the week in all kinds of different ways, on their headphones, on their radio car sets, in all kinds of different ways to the podcast. So if you're a podcast listener, a special welcome to you as well. You can find out how to listen via the podcast at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and join the many people who like to download the program. There are now, believe it or not, over 400 past episodes that you could potentially listen to because, as I said, the program's been going nearly 10 years now. Not always podcasting during that time, but still lots of episodes available online now. And you can listen to the last few as well. We'll be hearing some of your feedback to those towards the end of today's program. We've been recently in our Summer of Scripture, and we'll be hearing some more of your responses to that. But if you want more resources, features, videos, etc., the blog, and more, then do go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. If you want to get in touch about anything you hear on the programme today, can I encourage you to email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk or send me a Facebook or Twitter message at unbelievablejb on Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb to follow on Facebook. And we'll be hearing some of your reactions that way as well towards the end of today's programme. Later on today on the profile, you can hear Rachel Kerr, gospel artist, speaking to Sam Hales. That's between 4 and 5 this afternoon. Right now, though, let's get into the substance of today's show.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the programme, we're looking at the case from science for and against God. My guest today, Professor Peter Atkins. He's an Oxford scientist and academic, well known for his atheistic views and his repudiation of religion and science as being compatible. Zachary Arden is a PhD student in biology from New Zealand with undergraduate studies in biology and philosophy. A part-time apologist, he's our Christian guest on the programme today. And I'm looking forward to the interaction that we have. And what we're going to be doing is essentially a show of two halves. In the first part, Peter Atkins explaining why he believes science gives us evidence against God, and Zachary responding. And in the second half, Zachary giving his explanation for why he believes, on the contrary, science supports belief in God. And of course, Peter responding. First of all, Peter, thank you for coming on the programme today.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you with us. Have you ever had a period in your life where you've considered God as a possibility, or would you say ever since you were a young man you've been an atheist?
Oh, when I was a young boy, I wasn't thinking very much about things and didn't appreciate the power of science. Then I suppose God was the lazy way of answering the big questions. But, you know, as I came to understand the achievements of science and saw what it could answer and how it could go about answering, then the scales dropped from my eyes, as it were.
But you'd never had any, in that sense, active belief in God. It was an agnosticism, really.
It was Church of England boyhood.
Okay,
belief,
yes.
Whatever that means.
I've heard it said that has the effect more of inoculating someone against religion than
it may be the case, but there are other ways of inoculating against religion which are much more severe.
Anyway, it's great to have you on the show again, Peter. We've had you on a couple of times over the years, and it's always good to have your interactions. Zachary, welcome. You've come all the way from New Zealand to be on Unbelievable.
Though yes.
I don't think this is the only thing you're doing while you're over here, is it?
No, here for conferences as well, but it's great to be here.
It's great to have you on. You were suggested to me by a mutual friend of ours, I think, out in New Zealand, Glenn Peoples. And just very briefly, give us a sketch out your background and what's got you into looking at the relationship of science and religion.
Yeah, I guess as soon as I hit university and started studying biology, I was came in contact with quite strong atheism, and at the same time I was studying philosophy, so I decided to look into how these things might fit together. So I guess the more I've done that, the more I've seen that the metaphysical basis of science fits much better with Christianity than it does with naturalism.
You're a Christian yourself.
Yes.
Was that something sort of you kind of inherited? Would you say that you've been on a journey to get to where you are now?
I guess I've picked it up from various different places and people around me. And as I've tested it against what I've learned, decided that, yeah, I think it's true.
Yeah. Well, I'll make sure there are links from today's program webpage to both of you gentlemen, Zachary and Peter. If you want to find out more about my guest today, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Be interested in getting your thoughts as well as we get into today's subject and who you think makes the best case either for God from science or against God from science. That's the subject today on the show that aims to get you thinking. You can email your thoughts unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and I'll give out the other ways to get in contact a little bit later on in the programme.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, without further ado, Peter, I've suggested we split this into two halves and that you begin by giving, as it were, the I suppose you could call it the prosecution, why science gives us evidence against God. Because you're not one of those people who says, well, you know, science and religion can effectively, you know, live side by side. Maybe we don't sort of mix them up too much. But you believe science actively gives us evidence against the concept of God.
Well, I think you have to approach it in two different ways. One is to see why people are desperate to believe in God, and why many people do. And, you know, the whole variety of psychological reasons for that, and people fearful of their own annihilation, fearful of seeming alone in the world, just wanting, you know, help from outside, as it were. So there's a psychological urge towards belief. There might even be an evolutionary pressure on belief, in the sense that if you believe that you're going to go to a very pleasant afterlife, you're more likely to fight your enemies, and so you survive more. So there are psychological and anthropological reasons why people believe. But on the other side of the argument, there's no need for a God. I have to be cautious when I say that, because there are certainly great questions that science cannot answer. But we're edging towards answering those great questions. And I think it really just comes down to one big question, which is, you know, where it all came from. How absolutely nothing could emerge from something. Now, we haven't got a clue how that happens at the moment, but we do understand the history of the universe back to a fairly tiny fraction of a second after its inception. And it's only pessimism, I think, that we, at that point, we throw in the towel and say, we'll never understand. So science is edging towards an answer of that most profound of questions.
I suppose it could still be argued, well, that hasn't eliminated God.
You can't at this stage say absolutely there is no God, but it's such a lazy explanation of things. You know, people say, okay, we've got this great problem of where it all came from. It must have been done by something that we call a God. And that's an empty, lazy explanation. What we scientists are doing, edging back with drawing on experiment, drawing on theory, and one day to be able to say, that's it, that's how it happened.
Mm. What do you make of people who are scientists, who obviously have a very intellectual beliefs and call themselves Christians or theists? Do you think they're lazy intellectually?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You do?
Not lazy in their science, although, in my view, they are incomplete scientists.
Would you include people like Francis Collins, John Lennox, Alistair McGrath?
Oh, all of them.
All of them.
Yeah,
lazy intellectually.
Yeah, and they're in the grip of their cultural conditioning, I'm afraid, for whatever psychological reasons.
Could they not
they
put the same...
They ought to be put on a psychiatrist's couch, I think, to
wow.
explore the roots of their belief in faith rather than belief in science.
What would stop them turning around and say, surely we could say the same of your atheism, Peter, that is simply your cultural conditioning?
Absolutely, very happy to do that.
Okay, so you'd say they could say that. What would be your comeback, I suppose, to them?
Well, my comeback is that I have evidence that we can explain everything without needing to invoke the hypothesis of a god.
Mm, I have no need for that hypothesis.
Exactly.
Was it Bonaparte or someone?
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've heard
In a way, if I could add here, because it might well develop in the conversation that follows, I think it's much easier for a biologist to accept science as the complete explanation of all there is than it is for a physicist. After all, through natural selection, we understand the emergence of the richness of the biosphere.
Mm.
And that's really, we've answered the big questions of biological existence. The question that physicists are confronted with is a much deeper question, much harder question, and we certainly haven't.
Yes, so you tend to knock up against metaphysics more in physics than in
exactly.
biology.
Exactly.
But we do have a biologist with us, a PhD biologist, no less, Zachary Arden, who's going to be responding to you now, Peter. And I just encourage you both to, you know, have a discussion at this point as we continue in this cross examination now. Okay, intellectually lazy. That's the view that Peter has of people who are good scientists like you might be, Zachary, but still believe in God nonetheless. Where do you want to start with some of these issues that Peter raised, though?
Let's start with the idea of cultural conditioning. So the claim is that Christians are culturally conditioned and perhaps atheists aren't so much, or it doesn't really matter whether they are. I think it's a really important question. If it turns out we're both culturally conditioned, then that's not a very good argument against Christianity. So, yeah, Peter, could you maybe clarify?
Yeah, do you want me to come back at this point?
Yes, feel free.
To let you go.
Go ahead. Oh. You can come back on this one.
Yeah. What I'm culturally conditioned for is looking for minimalist explanations. What Zachary seems to be culturally conditioned for is looking for more elaborate explanations, because God is obviously a very elaborate explanation.
Well, we'll come to that, because I think when Zachary makes his positive case for God from science, he might have something to say on that. But your view, Zachary, what I'm hearing is, as far as you're concerned, atheists are just as culturally conditioned as Christians to accept atheism at some level.
Definitely. Within the scientific community, there's huge cultural pressure to accept some things rather than other things. But that doesn't mean that there's good evidence for those things rather than other things. So the next point is this idea that there's no need for a god, which I don't think science has done anything to show that, because the kinds of questions which science are answering are very different questions to the biggest questions, the metaphysical questions which philosophers are looking at. So this idea that Christians are intellectually lazy while scientists are not, firstly, a false contrast. There's plenty of Christians who are scientists, but they're asking both questions. They're not just answering the scientific questions.
Well, what questions do you have in mind that science can't elucidate?
Why does science work? Why is the...
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I think it works because the world is a kind of rational place. It depends upon the existence of laws. What science does is to go out looking for the laws that govern the behavior of matter and discover that they can understand it to make predictions.
Yeah, definitely. And I fully agree that the world is a rational place and the world is governed by laws. But scientists aren't asking, why is that the case? And I think Christian theism gives a good answer.
Theism. I disagree. I think that,
sure, but I'll explain why.
Let's allow Zachary to explain why he believes it does give a satisfactory explanation then.
So if we start with the possibility that the world was created by a rational mind who has an interest in certain things, and we contrast that with the possibility that the world was not created by anyone, that there is nothing behind the universe, and we compare those two hypotheses, the law-like rational nature of the universe fits much better with the theistic hypothesis than it does.
Because where did that rational mind emerge from in the first place?
And also, well, where did the universe emerge from?
The rationality of the world is the fact that it works through a network of relationships. So in a sense, logic is built into it. If there weren't rationality in the existence of the world, then it wouldn't exist.
So do you think the world has to be comprehensible by humans, or is that just a lucky accident that it turned out that way?
I think that's interesting. I mean, it's seriously interesting question.
Is that a question that science...
Our brains, which have emerged from the jungle, as it were, seem to be appropriate for ferreting out the deep structure of the universe.
And I
think that's an extraordinary... extraordinarily interesting question.
Is it a coincidence, is the question? Is it sheer blind luck?
So firstly that, and secondly, is that the kind of question that science is asking? Because you say science can ask can answer every interesting question. Is science even asking that question?
Yeah, of course it is. And it asks it in a whole variety of ways. First of all, it explores the nature of consciousness, and it's making progress there, which I'm afraid religion has really never made. It's exploring the question closely related to the one that you've been sort of hinting at, why mathematics is so profoundly effective in the description of the physical world, and people are beginning to speculate on why that might be the case. So, science realizes that there is deeply fascinating questions, but it also realizes that it's got to give them a lot of thought.
I mean, fascinating questions, but from your perspective, Peter, what I'm hearing is God is never the answer to such questions, whereas obviously, Zachary, you believe that God is the best explanation, that for given the universe we find ourselves in and its nature, it's perfectly rational to believe it came from a mind, because of the way we experience it, whereas that doesn't cohere well with the idea of a non-purposed, non-mind kind of beginning to the universe. I mean, do you want to just draw that out a bit and see what Pete has to say? Because what I'm hearing here is that you believe theism, the idea that there is a God, is perfectly plausible given the scientific nature of the universe we find ourselves in. Peter's come back to that was, but then you've got to explain where that mind came from. What's your response to that?
So firstly, I'd like to say that we use personal explanations as opposed to mechanistic explanations on an everyday basis. So it's not a complete cop-out to point to a personal explanation rather than a purely mechanistic explanation. The second question is, where did that mind come from? And I think I'll just say that every picture of the world needs to bottom out somewhere, and we need to start with something. The problem for the naturalist is we have no good reason to think that the material world is what is fundamental. We see that material things are contingent. They're the kind of thing that could have been otherwise. But I think it's very plausible that an immaterial mind would not be contingent. So if there is something behind the universe, it's much more plausible that it is something immaterial, like a mind, rather than material, given what we know about the universe.
Well, that's just gobbledygook, isn't it? I really don't understand what you're saying.
So do you understand...
this kind of disembodied mind. We know what mind is. We know that mind is the outcome of the functioning of the brain. We know that the brain is a conglomeration of interacting cells. We know that those cells work upon physicochemical principles. So to say that there is a kind of supermind out there, disembodied, that can effectively do what it wants and create a material universe, I think that's just fantasy.
I think it's very clear to us that there is a distinction between personal explanations and mechanistic explanations.
Yes, I agree with that, but I think to understand the personal explanation, you put your subject onto the psychiatrist's couch and you explore how they come to those that kind of understanding.
And those would still be personal explanations.
As it were, detached from the brain when it comes to personal understanding.
I mean, there is this question. You obviously say there's no evidence for a disembodied mind because, as far as you're concerned, Peter, all the evidence we have is for embodied minds in the sense of...
Yeah, absolutely.
You obviously have a very, you could say, reductionist view that it all boils down to chemical processes, physical processes, that somehow emergent from that is this thing we call a mind. But why is Peter wrong on that then? Does he have a point here that we don't have any other example of a non-embodied mind to speak of, Zachary?
I think the nature of the human consciousness is quite obscure. So I wouldn't want to...
It will always be obscure.
It will always be obscure. Is it one of those questions... Okay. Do you think it will always be obscure?
Not necessarily. That's an open question. But regardless, I think when we look at the universe, we see, as Peter has said, it has this rational nature, has this law-governed nature. And given our experience of the kinds of explanations we use every day, I think it's reasonable to say maybe there's a personal explanation for that, given that there is clearly no mechanistic explanation, if all such mechanistic explanations are contingent.
Well, I think that's nonsense. And also typical of philosophical pessimism. I mean, we scientists are edging towards understanding the nature of physical law and where physical law comes from. And it certainly doesn't come from imposition from a superior mind from outside, some kind of cosmic magistrate. It really comes from the structure of space-time, which we're starting to unravel.
Could you maybe talk through a little bit more of that? Where do these laws come from?
Well, I think the most important law in the universe probably is the conservation of energy, the fact that whatever you do, the total amount of energy in the universe is constant. So, and that law underlies so much of our scientific activity and scientific understanding and is really the root of causality and so on. But so it's a really big question about why energy is conserved. Where does the conservation of energy arise from? Was it imposed upon us by the lawgiver, or did it emerge from the structure of space-time? What you then have to do is to explore deep connections between laws of conservation, laws that say that things don't change, and laws of symmetry. There's a very profound theorem known as Netter's theorem, which says that whenever you've got conservation, there is associated with it some underlying symmetry. And what you discover is that the conservation of energy emerges from the uniformity of time. So what a scientist has to do in order to understand the origin of that profoundly important law is to understand why time is uniform. So we've pushed it back to a question that is almost... which we can conceive can be answered.
So do you think that this question of why time is uniform can be answered scientifically?
Yes. I think if you take the view that... let me just sketch why I think it can be answered. Suppose you've got absolutely nothing, which you probably had before there was a universe. Then absolutely nothing is totally uniform. When the creation took place, that total uniformity changed itself into space-time. And you can begin to see that maybe space-time sort of inherited that total uniformity. Hence, you get time that is uniform. Hence, you get the conservation of energy. And hence, you get causality.
So you can see that, extremely...
You know, we're not totally bereft of ideas.
Okay. I think you want to come back on this, Zachary.
I guess I just don't have many... substantial ideas in there. It seems very hand-waving. The word emerge keeps on being used.
The word creation was even used.
I have to hand-wave because I'm on the telephone.
but I mean, what you're saying is there's a lot of assumptions in there, Zachary, that Peter is assuming that all the questions will be scientifically answered in that sense. We'll get an ultimate explanation, scientific explanation for everything. You don't seem convinced about that.
Sure. Well, I think whenever we attempt a scientific explanation, it assumes that there is this deep irregularity in the universe. That's the nature of scientific explanation. It appeals to things like laws and causality. And why we should have laws and causality in the first place is not something that scientists have much to say about as scientists.
I just said something about it, so, I mean, that's evidence against what you've just said. I agree that it's not mainstream science at the moment, because mainstream scientists are doing much more targeted sorts of questions, but I'm arguing that it is not inconceivable that scientists can answer such deeply important questions. And I've been trying to indicate in a literally hand-waving way how those questions might emerge. I want to show that we scientists do take your questions and your worries seriously, but that we set out our stall of possible solutions.
Just a quick response, and then we'll go to the next part of our programme, Zachary.
I think that the question of the deeper regularities, the connection between mathematics and physical reality, what seems to be the rational nature of the universe, the not just mathematical nature, but the comprehensibility of the universe by humans. These are kind of deep questions which science, as science, doesn't really have much to say about.
We're going to go to a quick break. My guests today are Zachary Arden. He's a young biologist from New Zealand, taking the Christian side in the debate. On the atheist side, our protagonist is Peter Atkins, who's well known as an atheist scientist himself. And if you'd like to get in touch, again, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address. And find out the ways to listen, add your comments underneath the latest show at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And be back in a short moment's time for part two.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories.
Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
Jesus had completed his earthly ministry by the relatively young age of 33. In the latest edition of the magazine, we profile 33, 33 and unders, following in his footsteps by doing fresh things for God in their youth. We also meet TV preacher Joyce Meyer to talk passion and prosperity. Plus, be inspired by the testimonies of ex-convict James and ex-drug addict Susie. All that and much more.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley, and on Unbelievable we bring you Christians and non-Christians to do discussion and debate. And today we're looking at the case for and against God from science. My guests are Zachary Arden, a young biologist from New Zealand, and he's in conversation today with Peter Atkins, who's an ardent atheist and scientist, a long-standing one at that. So we're hearing their discussion today. If you want to take part yourself, though, and drop us a line, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, the email address. Or follow me on Twitter, @UnbelievableJB, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook address. And we'll be hearing some of your comments via Facebook and on the comment section of the latest show as well, a little bit later on today's programme. So, Zachary, let's hear your positive case, if you like. And I think we've heard hints of it already in the discussion so far, of why you believe science actually supports belief in God and why God is the best explanation for various aspects of the universe we find ourselves in.
Sure. So there's a couple of things I'd like to talk about. The first is the regularities in nature, which we've kind of talked about a little bit. And the second is some of the contingencies in nature, particularly biological contingencies. So just skim over the regularities point. I think it's really important that science aims at truth. It's not just a pragmatic project. It's not just something that we're doing to have a better agricultural industry or to produce various results. We're interested in what's the truth about reality. Mm. So at least I think we, me and Peter, agree on that point.
Could you agree on that, that's the aim of science, to find the truth of reality, Peter?
Holy, yes.
Okay, great.
Holy with a W, not just a H.
Yes, absolutely. At least there's one thing we agree on so far then. Okay, carry on, Zachary.
So I think the Christian view of the world, that the world is created by God, it's not the product of various local gods fighting with each other, as some ancient cultures thought. It's not the product of a mindless development out of chaos, but it is intended, helps to make sense of a number of features of the universe. So in order to make sense of the universe, we have to assume, or at least hope, that the universe is fundamentally sensible or comprehensible at some level, that we're not being tricked, that we're not setting out on a massively impossible task with very limited cognitive equipment. And when we do go to investigate the world, we find deep structure. We find universal laws, not a patchwork of inconsistent regularities. We find underlying order despite superficial appearances of chaos. And we also find beauty and elegance, and we even get personally deep satisfaction from the world. We experience awe, and we occasionally experience success as scientists.
I can't disagree with a word of what you said so far.
Good.
That's great.
Okay.
So, that's fantastic. So we agree on the premise, but so what's the conclusion? I'd say the Christian is not surprised at these findings. The Christian, believing already that there is a rational mind behind the universe, is not surprised that rationality should work its way through the universe in these ways.
Should the atheist be surprised? Why would an atheist might say, but you know, it's no surprise to me, as Peter kind of said in the first part. We wouldn't have a world if we didn't have a kind of a logical order to it in order for us to be able to exist within it.
Sure, we wouldn't be in such a world, but the fact we are in such a world still calls out for explanation. So this kind of anthropic principle doesn't explain why we are here.
I think, exactly, if I can interrupt there, this is, of course, where we start to diverge. We agree about the beauty, the comprehensibility, the presumed comprehensibility of the world and everything you said up to that point. Where we diverge is that you want all those things to be inherited from an external source, whereas I think that they all emerge from within the structure of the universe.
Right. I think the fact that should be the case is rather a mystery if we start with the assumption of naturalism, that behind the universe there's nothing transcendent and particularly nothing personal. That the universe should happen to be infused with rationality in this way is, I think, according to most...
Don't use slippery words, infused with rationality. You mean is comprehensible because there are laws of nature?
Yeah, and not just laws of nature, but particularly comprehensible laws, which are elegant, according to...
What do you mean by elegant? Do you mean simple?
Well, not just simple. So leading theoretical physicists often talk about the elegance or the beauty or the satisfaction...
Yeah, but they always
mean simple. Well, do they mean... I mean, theoretical physics is not simple as far as I'm concerned, but...
But the ultimate principles of any scientific explanation must be extraordinarily simple, but be rich in consequences. After all, you take natural selection, very, very simple idea, but it accounts for the elaboration of the biosphere.
So right, it's unclear.
Hewers of simplicity out of complexity.
Right, it's unclear why we should expect the world to be simple in this way, if there's no kind of ultimate guiding principle behind it.
It's
useful to assume that.
We should expect it to be simple.
So I think in science, actually, the default position is to assume chaos or stochastic processes rather than law-like processes. So you need evidence for law-like processes. Laws are the kind of thing that call out for explanation. Regularities...
Yes, which science, as I explained earlier, is beginning to group towards.
Right. Perhaps they are groping towards it. I'm still dubious about that. But even if that were the case, Christians... begin with that kind of assumption. So it's not a surprise for Christians, whereas at best it's something that naturalists can kind of try and find some kind of possible answer towards.
Yeah, but that's so lazy.
It's not lazy, because we're still doing the science.
What scientists are trying to do is to show that we can ferret out the very simple underlying mechanism of the world and show that when we allow it to run forward, we get the elaboration that we find awesome, whereas you want to start the other way around. You want an elaborate, awesome entity, a god, imposing itself upon the workings of the world. So you're working from completely the wrong end.
Okay, is that a fair summary of how you look at things, Zachary? An elaborate god sort of creating, you know, going the opposite way around, assuming this god exists and then saying he therefore created everything.
Right, the idea of complexity or what counts as elaborate is an important question. And it's easy to see what counts as complex when we're looking at our particles, when we're looking at chemical interactions, that kind of thing. But when we're talking about an immaterial mind, complex is not the right word. Elaborate, maybe. But I think it's entirely reasonable. The way we usually explain or many kinds of complexities and regularities in the world is in terms of personal explanation. Yeah.
Sorry, this some disembodied mind, what is it? Is that kind of jelly?
Jelly would be bodied, so no.
Yeah, so it's not even jelly. So what is it?
I'd say it's purely a mental substance. So it's something different.
It's part of your imagination.
Well, your imagination is also disembodied. But whatever it is, it's something different to the material universe. In order to explain the universe and the regularities therein, we need to appeal to something else.
Naturalists. Okay, so it's something outside which isn't even jelly.
Well, no, I mean
that's pretty convincing.
The jelly idea, I'm not sure where that came from, Peter, but obviously...
Well, I'm trying to strip away structure, because I know that mind emerges from an elaborate structure like your brain, my brain, and Zachary's brain, and everyone else's brain.
Right, well, when we talk about structure, that's not a purely physical thing, right? So structure
what else is there other than purely physical?
Well, mathematics, for starters.
Well, if you presume that mathematics somehow exists outside the human brains that developed it.
Well, mathematical truths are true independently of physical objects.
Yes, but they were discovered by the operation of human brains.
Yes, so we've discovered something which transcends the merely physical universe.
No, I didn't want to argue against you there, because in a very deep sense, I think... You know, there is something in what you're saying, in the sense that one of the most wonderful things about the world, as I alluded to before, is that mathematics is such an extraordinarily powerful way of developing our theories about it. And so the really a really deep question is why mathematics is so effective. And so a glib answer to that is that, in a sense, at root, the universe is mathematical.
Right, and why
so
that should be the case.
What we're doing when we develop mathematics is really mining out from the deep structure of the world mathematical truths. So I think, you know, I certainly wouldn't want to argue.
Okay, so you think Zachary's onto something there, in as much
only by mistake, really.
Right, so I'd like to say that the existence of spatially universal, temporally constant, and mathematically elegant laws of nature is much more expected if the universe is the result of a mind, a powerful, loving mind of God, than it is if naturalism is true. If the universe is some kind of freak show, there's no one watching, no one cares, it just happens.
Wouldn't it be wonderful? Can't you see this? That, you know, if no one cares, if there's no mind out there, that the universe comes into existence.
Well, what do you think is wonderful?
It is rational. And out of that growth, out of that grows the wonder.
Are you saying that you prefer the idea of rationality and beauty and wonder and the science and everything coming from a completely non-rational source, from a completely, if you like, a non-purposive source?
You prefer that idea to the idea of it coming from a rational mind? So that question was directed at me, was it?
It was. So do you prefer, if you like, an irrational or irrational genesis for...
No, what I prefer is the emergence from within the structure of the universe itself of the laws of nature and the glorious consequences of them. What I find offensive, really, is saying, well, you know, the universe can't look after itself. It has to have some kind of magistrate overseeing it.
Right, well, I guess I'd just say that Professor Atkins is very strong in the idea that there are no miracles, but I think on his view, scientific understanding becomes something of a miracle. The comprehensibility and the deep structure of the universe are something of a miracle.
If
you mean by miracle not having any physical explanation, then I disagree.
Deeply improbable and unexpected, given the a priori assumption of naturalism.
I don't know about improbable. I don't know how you judge that, and I don't know what you mean by expected.
Right, but do you agree that if there were a mind behind the universe, we might expect something like the applicability of mathematics to the universe?
I can see that if there is something extremely elaborate out there and that we're just sort of marionettes being jerked around by his strings.
Hang on, Zachary hasn't said any of that. You're slightly characterising his argument.
It's a kind of... In fact, the marionettes and the strings are kind of concepts rather than actualities. Mm. So I don't see the need for it, really, if the universe can account for its own accountability, then there is no need to ask for an external controller.
Right, and it seems that you start off with the hopeful assumption that it can account for itself.
We scientists are optimists.
Right.
Philosophers are pessimists and theologians are obfuscators.
Right, well, as a scientist, I'm also optimistic. I just think I've got grounds for my optimism, grounded in the rational mind of God. Your optimism is unfounded.
Is that there is a God, so you're being driven to look for evidence for
This seems a little bit like an ad hominem attack, almost, Peter. At this point, you've said this.
Oh, I don't mean that. I'm just.
You're attributing to Zachary. You know, well, you're just looking for God because you already believe in God, and so you're looking for.
Yeah.
And you said right at the outset, and I'm interested in your response to this. You said, well, people believe for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah.
You know, they want to believe in something bigger than themselves.
It's a
psychological crutch, was what I was getting really, I suppose, from you.
Yes.
But what's your answer to that, Zachary? Because does that have any bearing on the question of whether God exists or not, the fact that people might have a variety of reasons for coming to believe in God?
Yeah, I mean, some people want to believe in God, some people don't want to believe in God, some people want to believe the universe is elegant, some people want to believe it's complicated. People want all kinds of things, but as scientists, we need to work out what's actually true and which system makes better sense of the world.
Yes, I agree with that.
But Zachary very firmly comes down on the belief that the concept of a God, if you like, a purposive, creative mind behind the universe, is a far better explanation for the universe we inhabit than a, if you like, completely we don't have an explanation on atheism.
It's just basically a lazy explanation.
Well, you keep saying lazy. What's the problem then, Zachary?
Well, because you're throwing in the towel. You say that okay, the problem is too difficult to explore and try to understand from within the universe, as it were. So you say, I've got the explanation. God did it.
I just disagree. So I'd say the task of scientists is to explain as much as we can from within this universe. But whatever...
I'm agreeing with you, you see.
It's great.
You go off at a tangent.
So we need to explain this God concept every time.
As much as we can. Yeah. But I'd say that there are fundamental assumptions inherent to science, which science is not going to be able to explain.
Pessimism again. When you say is not going to, you're showing
because your pessimism. Of the nature of science. The nature of science assumes... the coherence of mathematics. The nature of science assumes that mathematics is applicable to the physical universe. The nature of science assumes that there are universal laws.
Yes.
The nature of science assumes that those laws will continue to hold over time. And the Christian God gives an explanation for why those things should be the case. Naturalism.
I agree with all your premises, and then you go shooting off
isn't simply what Zachary's saying is it's an inference to the best explanation for the universe as we find it.
Best explanation.
Well,
I think the best explanation comes from avoiding the imposition of hypotheses. Now, it seems to me that what Zachary is doing is agreeing, is setting out a series of points with which I agree, and then suddenly changing from his left hemisphere to his right hemisphere and saying, I've got this wonderful hypothesis which does it all.
That's fantastic, because I really wanted to talk about that point. So I think it's very important that the Christian God was not invented to explain the deep structure of the universe. It's not just an ad hoc concoction. No. It's not a goblins in the attic. It's not fairies in our back lawn.
No. Although although I sort of partly agree with that, you have to agree that Abrahamic, or sort of monotheistic gods, let's call it that, emerge from the amalgamation of gods of this and gods of that.
Well, but so that's completely beside the point.
Let's come back to that if we have time.
Gone into the mix.
That's more of a sociological question. But just develop your point that you were starting out on there.
Yeah, sure. I'd love to talk about the nature of God and why we believe this God rather than that God. But the point I wanted to make is that the reason that the Christian God was initially was believed in was because of historical reasons. It was nothing to do with these kind of deeper questions like the nature of mathematics, the nature of science, the nature of morality, which it happens to do very well in answering. But the original reason for believing the Christian God was particular historical events recorded in the Old and New Testaments. In particular, of course, the history around Jesus. That's something which I think quite often in your debates you don't really go too close to, but that's the key question for Christianity, is why originally did people come to this belief? And then secondly, we can come to test it against the data. But I think it's really important that we do have these independent reasons.
Far as you can believe them. I mean, you don't really believe everything you read in the Bible, do you? Do you believe that the Bible is literally true in every word?
I believe everything that the Bible affirms is true, yes. So one reason to think that is that...
So you agree that when Jesus saw that someone was mad, that he extracted the madness from that person and introduced it into the Gadarene swine.
Right, so you're inserting words into that text there, Peter. The text doesn't say when Jesus saw someone was mad, he extracted the madness. You're inserting words into that text. I believe, yes, everything the Bible affirms is true.
And you believe that creation was in 6 real days, do you?
So no, I'm not a young earth creationist because I don't think that's what Genesis...
So why don't you believe that?
I don't think that's what Genesis is actually affirming when you look at that text closely. So there's plenty of Old Testament scholars around
you. Do you believe in Adam and Eve?
I think
you believe that all humans sprang from Adam and Eve. You believe in Noah's Ark.
So I think the Adam and Eve question is an important historical question. These are things which Christians can differ. But the question is, what is the nature of the text? And I understand this is a very strong claim, but more importantly, for these historical beliefs, particularly around the New Testament, around Jesus, you don't need to have that high view of the Bible. You just need to ask, is this an historically accurate document to some extent? Does it make claims that are true about history? That's
Even
a very different question.
The Bible is in conflict with itself.
I think you need to flesh out what you mean by that. But when you look at the New Testament, particularly the Gospels, these make a bunch of historical claims that can be tested against secular history, can be compared with each...
years after the events they purport to describe.
So, sorry, when were the Gospels written?
And political documents rather than historical documents.
Yeah, I've heard you say that many times before, actually, Peter, and I'm curious, where does this idea that the Gospels are political propaganda come from?
Or written hundreds of years after the events.
And you want to establish a sect, then you need propagandists.
Right, so your assumption is Christianity was the sect that was established hundreds of years later, and then you insert that into the text.
Yes, by Paul.
Hundreds of years later.
Well, decades later, let's put it that way.
So perhaps 2 decades later with some of these writings. There's a difference between 20 years and hundreds of years. And I think when you look at this historically and scientifically, you see the New Testament is actually reliable. So that's an open question for you as a scientist to explore without importing these assumptions of naturalism into the text.
So you believe in the resurrection, presumably?
Yes, definitely.
You believe in the virgin birth, even though you're a biologist?
Yes. The idea of a miracle is that it doesn't happen very often. That's why they're miraculous.
I've got to that. Otherwise, the universe would not be a very rational place, would it?
So do you believe that Zachary is not only intellectually lazy for believing in God, but also for believing in the possibility of miracles? Do you think that is an unscientific thing to believe in?
Yes, I do, actually, for the following reason. It's not just prejudice. Well, I suppose prejudice comes into it, but I can rationalise my prejudice, if you like, just to make sure that you understand where I'm coming from. I think that science is such a reticulation of concepts that one part depends upon ideas and theories that emerge from, say biology, depend upon ideas that have emerged, let us say, from physics or from chemistry and so on. So it's a whole network of mutually supporting concepts and theories. If in any part of that network an intellectual bomb would go off, that is, a miracle would occur. That is something that cannot be accounted for by the normal operation of the laws of nature, then the whole fabric of science would fall. So in a way, what Zachary is setting himself up to say, although perhaps he doesn't realise it, he believes that the whole universe is a rational place that can be understood because of the imposition of some kind of mind of God onto it. What he's just said is that this rationality can be destroyed.
At any point, it could all unravel. Okay, that's so Peter's view is that supposing that miracles are possible, it kind of undermines the rationality that you're so keen to present it within the universe. What's your response to that, Zachary?
Well, firstly, this very strong idea of the laws of nature that Peter is espousing, I think, is going to be very hard to account for given naturalism. So that comes back to the same question. So he's very strong in saying no miracles, only law. Laws are comprehensive. They are all these things. I'd ask, you know, where does this idea of law come from? And secondly, I think it's just entirely reasonable to think that occasionally God can override his own laws. If the laws are God's, it's reasonable to think he might.
I mean, I sometimes think of it as
God on the outside who can do more or less anything at a whim.
Right, but the point of miracles within the Christian tradition is that they don't occur very often. So I don't think it's a problem for routine everyday science because God is not...
Would you liken it, I don't know, to something like a computer programmer, say, has the ability to write the laws of the code for his program, but and when the program runs, it runs according to those laws and codes, but the computer programmer being outside can easily feed in a new law or change something, tweak something. Would you say that God sort of has that kind of power in as much as he is able to, if you like, occasionally do something outside of the regular laws of nature in that sense?
Sure. And I think the reason we trust the laws, as a Christian, the reason I trust the laws are rational is because God is not arbitrary. So I trust that God is not arbitrary in his interactions with nature. So believing in the resurrection, for instance, does nothing to overturn science. It's a one-off event. That's the whole point.
Of course it does have something to overturn science. I mean, the whole point about dying is that it's irreversible.
The whole point, that in the naturalistic picture, there is no point. I don't understand where you get this idea of there being a point about
dying.
Well,
I mean, the outcome of dying is its irreversibility.
So that's why the idea of the resurrection is so important, because it's this one-off event... That shows that the laws of nature are not...
Well, it's imaginable, of course. It's a wonderful fairy story, but you can't really believe that it took place.
The reason that the resurrection is impressive is because of the background of regularity. The background of regularity shows that this is a miracle. If the universe was chaotic and random and it wasn't guided by laws, the miracles would not be significant. But because they are guided by laws...
The virgin birth, I mean, you're astonished that you as a biologist would even countenance its plausibility. What could you say about Jesus' DNA?
That God specially created a Y chromosome. What's the problem with that?
And a strip of DNA?
Well, that's what a Y chromosome is.
Yeah, I understand. So he nailed together lots of fragments of molecules and conjured up a piece of DNA.
We're talking about someone who created the universe. A strip of DNA is not too big in comparison.
No, I agree, but you can see how absurd it is.
No, I can't actually. I can see why someone enculturated in your particular tradition might see it as absurd, but I don't see any basis for your assertions.
We're going to take a quick break and we're going to have final thoughts in just a moment. So we'll be concluding our discussion on whether science makes the case for or against God. In a very short moment's time, we'll also be hearing some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme. Hope you can come back and join us right through to the end of Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. Don't forget you can listen back to today's programme and add your comments too at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Welcome back to the final part of this week's Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley. Hope you're enjoying the summer, and I hope you enjoyed our Summer of Scripture, four shows in which believing and non-believing Bible scholars joined me for a variety of discussions and debates during during July and August. So we'll be hearing some more of your feedback to the programmes with Gary Habermas and James Crossley towards the end of today's programme. They were debating things like the minimal facts approach to the resurrection and a Q&A on Bible questions as well. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch, I'll be giving out the ways to do that a little bit later on. If you're interested in what's coming up next week, we're going to another change of topic again, as two guests join me, Andy Bannister and Ed Turner. Andy Bannister heads up RZIM, Ravi Zacharias International Ministries in Canada, but he's an Englishman. So's Ed, as it happens. In fact, they met each other several years ago, near the beginning of Unbelievable, really. And so it's nice to bring them together again several years later. Andy has written a book called The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, and he's going to be talking about that book, and we're going to be debating some issues around that with Ed, who's an atheist himself. So look out for that on the show next week at the same time. Later on today, on The Profile, straight after Unbelievable, you can hear gospel artist Rachel Kerr talking about her life, faith, ministry and music to Sam Hales. But right now, it's time to get back into the final part of today's discussion. We're talking about whether science makes the case for or against God. My guests, Peter Atkins and Zachary Arden.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
We've had some really interesting discussions so far, Peter. We're just time for really for some final reflections as we've heard the case from science for and against God. What are you left with? Has anything that Zachary has said today at all, nudged you in any particular direction?
Yes, there's hope for him, I think. I hope that doesn't sound too condescending. But he and I agree that the world is an extraordinarily wonderful place and is worth investigating, and that science is an extraordinarily powerful way of coming to the truth. And so,
when you say that science, if you like, is the ultimate arbiter for all the things we do and the questions that we need to answer, I suppose I'm interested in wondering why is it a scientific, if you like, outcome, the search for truth? Is that something that science dictates, that we should be looking for truth? It sounds like there's a value you place on looking for the truth, Peter. Is that something that you can get from science, though, if you like, I'm wondering?
Well, it's a way of passing the time between the cradle and the grave, isn't it?
Right.
And so personally, it's a pleasing thing to do. I think, you know, psychologically, I find it attractive gradually to grow my understanding of the workings of the world.
But if say, another person finds no delight whatsoever in pursuing truth, psychologically speaking, is there any sense in which they have a less valuable life because of that? I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's, they probably might find happiness and contentment in other ways. They might just play football all day, something like that, and good for them. But I think they're losing something of the human capability. Yeah. They're not fulfilling the human capability.
It's just that the reason I'm asking these questions is just that I very often find with scientists who say that they're atheists, that they're still nevertheless almost a sense of a teleology, a purpose behind what they're doing. It's like they're looking for something. Yeah. And to me, that's not a million miles away from saying there's something out there to be discovered, there's a kind of a purpose that science is moving us in the direction of.
Yeah.
It's not just a blind, random process.
Absolutely not. No, it's an ascent into comprehension. And it's been extraordinarily, we owe a debt to Christianity in the past, which kept the thought of exploration, intellectual exploration, alive. It didn't light upon the appropriate tools. It went too inward on itself. What science has done is to show that in this collaboration across the cultures, this worldwide collaboration, and this collaboration over time as well, over space and time, is using the very simple process of experimental observation allied with theoretical formulation, it is proving to be the best way, I think, of discovering what it's all about.
Right. Final thoughts from you, Zachary, as we finish this debate today.
Yeah, well, I think today we've mostly talked about the regularities and the deep structure. I think that's important. I didn't get to talk much about the contingencies of this world. I'd just briefly say that the evolutionary process is very contingent, very improbable. That it would throw up anything in particular is very improbable. There's no reason to expect one thing over another. Whereas Christian theism gives you some reason to expect the kind of endpoint that we see in terms of human beings. So Stephen Jay Gould has said that human complexity is an ultimate and oddball rarity. So there's a number of features of the world that are extremely unlikely. There's no reason to expect them if naturalism is true, but they fit really nicely with Christian theism.
That would be a fascinating one to explore in proper detail another time, maybe, with an atheist biologist, perhaps. But, there's various strands you bring together in that sense, Zachary, to support your view. I mean, what you haven't argued from here is a kind of a very specific sort of, here's the complexity of the DNA molecule or something as a sort of intelligent design type argument for a creator. You've taken this more at a sort of level of the nature of the universe we inhabit, its regularity, law-like things, the end product of evolution and so on. These are kind of, if you like, pointers back toward a transcendent source is what I've had from you today.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great that I can agree with Peter on so many things. And I just want to ask, what are the implications of these things that we agree on? Do they really fit as nicely with naturalism as we think? Science is a fantastic tool and it's a fantastic endeavor. But I don't think we should identify it with naturalism, the idea that nature is the only thing.
Or presumably, as Peter says, he's an optimist, and that, do I hear from you as well, Peter, you believe that ultimately all the questions could be answered?
Oh, yeah, I don't see why not.
Science.
All the serious questions. I mean, there are silly questions, but which mostly are the domain of theology. But on the whole, all the serious questions.
All the serious questions. Are you less optimistic that science has all the answers that we ever really need, Zachary?
Well, I just think when I look at the nature of science, I see that it has certain things which it requires, just as any discipline does. It takes certain things for granted and goes on to build on that to explore the natural world. But why these things should be the case is an open question, which Christian theism, based on historical claims, which are verifiable historically, helps to make sense of.
Thank you both for joining me on the programme today. Zachary Arden and Professor Peter Atkins, been fascinating to have you both. I'll make sure there are links to both your websites where people can find out more about your books, writings and other things as well. That's from premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. In the meantime, Peter, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
And Zachary, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, before we go to some of your more serious feedback, I had a couple of fun things that came in the last week or two. A couple of people, actually, who got in touch suggesting an alternative theme tune to the Unbelievable show. Now, those who listen regularly will be very familiar with the theme tune that begins and ends the programme every week. And that is, of course, the hit Unbelievable by EMF. Very much an early 90s hit here in the UK. But I struck upon that when the show first came into existence as a rather good theme tune for the programme. What I didn't realise is that there are some alternative versions of that song that have been covered out there. So Devon got in touch with me to say, have you thought about including this one as your show theme tune? So shall we listen to this particular version of Unbelievable?
You're unbelievable. Check the method when I cop it. No, no joke like Bronco. Laugh on Johnzo. I'm in his condo in Toronto. Either way, never come stare. Just to confuse the one there. Watch me dropping a dick with the sun down. It's smoke clear, but you think I'll be standing there gripping four mics and swinging the chords up in the air like cowboys. When you're rocking the territory in this rap game, in Christ blessed us with the octane. Same name created the world in 7 days. Change your life, you've been the maze man. Don't trip. We gon' carry on with the function. Watch preparing the power punch in the thing.
so unbelievable. I just want to make jam. Pack the clubs and stay together so people are all tight.
Just a snippet, but a very different rendition of your favourite show's theme tune, I'm sure you'd agree. In fact, that one by Thousand Foot Crutch, and you might have been able to tell, if you listen closely to the rapping, that it's a Christianised version, Thousand Foot Crutch being a Christian band. I'm not convinced that that's going to replace the EMF original version, personally. But thank you very much for the suggestion, Devin. And you can go and look that up if you want to, The Unbelievable. It's on YouTube. They're Thousand Foot Crutch's version of Unbelievable. And then this was from Martin Saunders, who stumbled across this particular video on Facebook. The singer, and I use the term loosely, has also made a song called Unbelievable. It's not a cover of the EMF version, but it has its own unique appeal. Let's listen to a little bit of it.
What you are. Come be my coffee table and I'll be your sofa. Unbelievable, so near yet so far. Please be the man, the cable to my cable car. You blossom like a flower. I'm so stunned like the devil. My God, you are unbelievable.
Yes, the artist in question comes from Singapore, and the video in question is equally interesting as the song. So, no, I don't think, though, that I'm quite persuaded that that will make it into the hallowed halls of regularly playing on Unbelievable as the theme tune. We'll stick with the EMF version. But if you have an idea for a theme tune, if you think that, you know, at the 10-year mark this autumn of Unbelievable, we really should upgrade to a different theme tune for the show, I'd be interested in hearing your suggestions. Be very happy to take them. So you can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk if you'd like to send me your suggestion for an alternative show theme tune. But in the meantime, thanks to Martin and Devin for getting in touch with their ideas. Don't forget, you can find Unbelievable online. All the links to the Facebook, Twitter, etc., and all the past shows, interviews, features, videos from past conferences, and much more at the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and the ways to get in touch all listed there. So let's go to some of your thoughts about recent programs. Firstly, I'm going to go to some of the emails that came in response to James Crossley and Gary Habermas. In fact, I received some requests for things for us to look at in that Bible Q&A of last week, but that came in too late, but I thought were interesting comments in and of themselves. Here's one from Andrew Loke, research assistant professor, in fact, at the University of Hong Kong. And he said, I'd like to ask a question about the difficulty many historians have concerning how it's possible, in principle, to reason from certain historical facts to Jesus's resurrection. I would like to ask, why cannot a historian in principle argue that there are reasons and evidences for everything, for thinking that 1, 2, 3, 4 are true? So, and you list them here. 1, many people claim to have seen the resurrected Jesus shortly after his death. 2, they did not lie but truly experienced something. 3, what they experienced was not caused intramentally but extramentally. 4, the extramental entity was not another person but the same Jesus who died on the cross. Therefore, Jesus resurrected. This utilises a simplified version of the logical, exhaustive list of hypotheses published in The Resurrection of the Son of God, a reduction of the Naturalistic Alternatives, Journal of Theological Studies, in 2009. Historians do regularly assess whether certain people make certain certain claims in history, whether it's likely that certain people lied and whether it's likely that people witnessed someone doing certain things rather than saw a hallucination or mistook another person. So what's the problem? Crossley might reply that the problem is that the supernatural is involved in the resurrection. But the need to distinguish supernatural and natural isn't even required up to this point of establishing 1, 2, 3 and 4. Rather, the need to distinguish supernatural and natural only comes after the conclusion, therefore Jesus resurrected, is reached. It is only then that we need to reflect on whether Jesus resurrected has a natural or supernatural cause. One can then argue that given our well-founded understanding that people do not naturally rise from the dead, and given the significant religious context of Jesus' ministry, we can reasonably conclude that it has a supernatural cause in this case. And you send me a link to that 2009 Journal of Theological Studies article. And you say, by the way, I now think that one can give good arguments for thinking all of those premises are true, even without establishing the evidentially significant details in the Gospels in the way that that article originally stated. Rather, the minimal facts, together with a number of considerations, such as those which Habermas has discussed, would be sufficient. So, Andrew, they're coming in on the case for, if you like, giving a proof for the resurrection from historical facts. Tara got in touch because she wanted to ask a question, and unfortunately this again arrived too late for me, Tara. Said, please start at square one. What basic proof do we have that it was Jesus on the cross? The Roman soldiers needed Judas to point out Jesus to arrest him, right? Obviously Jesus' identity wasn't that well known then, even by those wanted to crucify him. So any chance Judas pointed out someone else, a willing convert, someone who loved Jesus and wanted to protect him? This substitute would die believing that God would reward him in heaven. If so, then at the execution, who would have tried to correct the error? And Peter denied knowing Christ three times. Could that mean Peter was trying to say that the man the Romans held was not Jesus? Please ask your guest. Please. And you also go on to say, Tara, 400 plus shows and you've never had a Christian versus atheist guest seriously debate the idea of a substitute on the cross or the swooning possibility or even the somewhat crazy Jesus's twin brother possibility. All the plethora of alternatives to the resurrection. Now, there's a topic for a future show which would stir up both sides of your audience, eh? Excuse me, I'm Canadian. Ha, love you and your show. Thanks, Tara. I mean, we've obviously discussed the idea of, Jesus being replaced by someone else on the cross, because that is very common in Islamic theology. But we haven't done it, as it were, between two Bible scholars as such. I don't know. I mean, the question is whether there's anything going in the theory that Jesus was replaced on the cross. It doesn't seem to me that there's any, apart from wanting to avoid, perhaps, the question of how the resurrection occurred, that would be the only reason for suggesting that there was someone else in Jesus's place, given that all the sources we have clearly state that it was Jesus. And the thing about Peter denying Christ three times, well, the whole point is that, you know, the stories as they're recorded tell us that he wept bitterly because he presumably felt the pain of recrimination at having betrayed Jesus. I guess that would be my unscholarly response to you. But I wish we had been able to put that to our guests on the show. I think it would have been interesting to get their perspective on that, especially in light of, you know, the fact that many Muslims do claim that Jesus was supplanted, if you like. Lots of comments on that show on the minimal facts, whether we can get to a resurrection from these minimal facts by Gary Habermas. So let's go to some of the comments that came in underneath the show on the show page. Chris Goswami said of James Crossley, "At last, a philosopher from up north who talks like what I do. How refreshing. Having said that, I think James must be one of the most believing non-believers you've ever had on the show. Anyway, good to know that there are non-believers out there who will give ground to the evidence, even if they don't in the end choose to believe themselves. Really enjoyed listening." J.D. Walters, "A good conversation overall. It seemed, however, that Gary was fudging a bit in response to the question of why he treats the resurrection differently from other miracle claims. I think two simple things can be said in response. Firstly, we need to look at the quality of the evidence case by case. And secondly, we should be prepared to grant the occurrence of other miracles, or more neutrally, extraordinary happenings, including ones in other religious traditions. It may make some Christians squirm, but at the very least, those occurrences lend plausibility to a broad non-naturalism tide that lifts all religious boats, including the Christian one." Tom Hilton says, this programme was great, at least partly for the accents. I found it really helpful to stand back and look at the facts. Very impressive, even just taking the smaller set that James readily agreed with. It all comes down to whether you accept God exists. Now, Peter O'Brien responded to Tom there and said, I guess believers and non-believers have different standards, thresholds and definitions of what constitutes a fact. In my view, something written in an ancient book of unclear authorship with no independent corroborative evidence is not a fact, especially if the authors are suspected of not being disinterested parties. This is an allegation or a possibility, not a fact. I accept Jesus Christ's crucifixion as fact because there is independent evidence for it, although the mistaken identity slash substitution theory cannot be ruled out entirely. There are many ancient books that describe things that also have no independent corroborative evidence. Christians don't call these facts, e.g. the story of Apollonius of Tyana, or Muhammad flying to heaven on a winged horse. Also, many other gospels were rejected by the early Christians as unreliable. So presumably, they included things presented as facts which were not facts. And it goes on in like manner. Interesting point there, Peter. I think that the difference would be, again, just my opinion on this, Gary's listed as the minimal facts are, if you like, well established, if you like, by the broad majority of New Testament historians, whether they're believers or not, as if you like being well attested by the standards of the literary genre that we're talking about in the ancient world. Now, that doesn't mean they're fact, like a scientific fact might be a fact, but they are, you know, as broadly as they're defined in historical terms, as good as facts. Lots more people responding on this. Paul Harton Haler says, a fact, as far as history is concerned, is something that, upon inspection of sources using various criteria of historicity, was, according to such sources, very likely to have occurred. For example, the Jewish scholar Paula Friedrichsen, in 1999's Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, A Jewish Life, says, the challenge of placing Jesus coherently within his native early first century environment is aided by the handful of indisputable facts. His encounter with John the Baptizer, his popular following, his proclamation of the kingdom of God, his crucifixion by Pilate in Jerusalem, the survival of his core followers who took up his proclamation of the kingdom while identifying Jesus as Christ risen from the dead, and extending the mission out from its Jewish matrix to also include Gentiles. You also quote from the liberal Christian scholar E.P. Sanders in The Historical Figure of Jesus, that Jesus' followers and later Paul had resurrection experiences is, in my judgment, a fact. We know a lot about Jesus. We know that he started under John the Baptist, that he had disciples, that he expected the kingdom, that he went from Galilee to Jerusalem, that he did something hostile against the temple, that he was tried and crucified. Finally, we know that after his death, his followers experienced what they described as the resurrection, the appearance of a living but transformed person who had actually died. So there you go, just a smattering of the types of responses we got from there. I will say that very often looking at the nature of the responses underneath the show as it gets posted to the webpage, the vast majority of responses are actually from non-Christians. And I very much value, if you're a Christian, you know what you're about when it comes to apologetics and this kind of stuff, why not go on there and add your thoughts as well? Because it's not as interesting simply if you don't have a good to and fro when it comes to the skeptics and the Christians having a little bit of a chit chat on there. But in any case, thanks to all those who do regularly post on that particular area of the website. On Facebook, when I posted it there to the Unbelievable Facebook page, I had equally a lot of interesting responses. Paul Arnold, who said, I listened on podcast during a 7-hour drive to Devon and was completely engaged. A really well-balanced debate with some surprising level of agreement. And Matt Crump, I've really come to like the Habermas minimal fact approach from Paul's epistles. Perhaps it doesn't prove a resurrection by historical standards, but by tracing material back within a year or two of ground zero, it certainly makes it intellectually permissible. James was also a very engaging guest, and I suppose you have to respect his position. Can't wait for the Q&A. Well marshalled again, Justin. It's been a good month. Jim says, the writer of Luke Acts, writing about half a century after the event, seems to imply that actually seeing the resurrected Jesus soon after the crucifixion was only for a select few. This adds another level of constraint on obtaining evidence for a historical resurrection. Does anyone here have a tally of how many people are reported in the New Testament to have seen the resurrection of Jesus? My quick estimate is around 520 to 525. And if that's way too low, well, just slap me and call me Satan. But I'm still in interested in a careful approximate number from anyone. And finally, on a sceptical note as well, John Humberstone writes, OK, what do we have here? JB says, so Gary, can you show that the resurrection is the best explanation based on a set of minimal facts and nothing else? Is that correct? Gary Habermas, yes, Justin, and here they are. James Crossley, yes, I agree with all of those, but I don't see how that gets us to a bodily resurrection. Gary Habermas, yes, but if you take also into account NDEs, verses from the Gospels where Jesus talks about his death and resurrection, belief in God and miracles, what just happened there? So anyway, thank you very much. Good to get your interactions, whether by Facebook, at the show page or email. Hope you've enjoyed that selection of programmes that we were calling the Summer of Scripture. And I look forward to your responses to today's programme, because it was a fun one, wasn't it, with Peter Atkins and Zachary Arden. In the meantime, thanks for listening to the programme today. And let me tell you what's coming up at the same time next week.
You're unbelievable.
My Christian guest is Andy Bannister. He's the author of a new book, The Atheist Who Didn't Exist. He's going to be in conversation with an atheist who does exist, Ed Turner. Find out what happens next week here on the show that aims to get you thinking. Until then, have a great week, and the profile's here next.
Lowe's knows that more projects mean more tools. For a limited time, new and existing MyLowe's Rewards credit card members can get 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more, in-store and online. Don't wait to get the things you need. Get special financing today. Lowe's. We help. You save. Now through August 27th, choose 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more. Offer subject to credit approval and cannot be combined. Minimum monthly payments required. See store or Lowe's.com for details.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.